morning. Welcome to the morning show here on 88.5 KRFY. I'm one of today's hosts, Chris Bessler, and I'm here with Will Love, who's also an occasional News of the Week host. Hey, Will.
Hey, how's it going, Chris?
We haven't been in the studio together for months.
I know, it's been a little while, yeah. But it's great to see you. I hope you're having a great summer.
Yeah, it is. I'm having a really fine summer. And we have with us Zach Hagedone. He's the editor of the Sandpoint Reader. Zach, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
And, of course, there's always a lot of news to talk about. I'm going to rattle off some of what are probably the top news stories of the week, and then we'll come back and dig in on a couple of them in more detail, especially with Zach here, because Zach has got insights on stuff that Will and I can only guess at.
Exactly.
Being a hands-on reporter. So probably the top story of the week is a local woman was arrested and made her first court appearance for the suspected arson of the Army surplus on July 4th. The judge has set the bond at $1 million for Jennifer S. Meyer, and potential motive hasn't been given by police. The investigation is ongoing. We'll circle back on that one. Also this week, the city council approved the first upgrade in 15 years to the city comprehensive plan. The plan runs 140 pages. It covers community vision, character, design, land use, growth, multimodal transportation, parks and recreation, and more. And that's another one I hope to circle back on with Zach. Also in the news, after a nationwide search, it turns out the best new director for the East Bonner County Library was right here all along. The library board of directors have named Vanessa Velez, who has been serving as interim director the past several months, as the new director after interviewing six highly qualified candidates from around the country. And someone better tell the geese at City Beach to watch out, because on Wednesday, the city's new off-leash dog program began. There are now seven permitted dogs with their dog owners that are allowed to chase geese at the City Beach in hopes of deterring them from hanging out there in the park. The past couple of years, the city resorted to capturing and killing geese, but the hopes are that these dogs, which they call the Pondere Paw Patrol, I like that name.
Sounds like a Saturday morning cartoon.
Yeah. It actually is. My kids used to love that show.
It might be, but they're hoping that they'll be around frequently enough that they will, you know, consistently scare the geese away. They did try dogs once upon a time, but the dogs were there for just like an hour, and the geese figured that out, and they'd leave for an hour, and then they'd come back. So all these dogs have passed obedience tests, and if you're at the beach, you'll be able to identify them because they're wearing yellow and black vests. But if you have a dog that would qualify for this program and you want to be able to run off leash and chase a few geese, then go to the city website, because they are looking for more dogs and dog owners. A couple more stories here. Schweitzer has purchased the backcountry ski operations of Selkirk Powder. Selkirk Powder is operated out of the ski resort with guided ski, snowmobile, and snowboard touring off the backside of the resort under a land lease from the Idaho Department of Lands. Selkirk Powder is going to continue operations at a new location that accesses state land in the Selkirk Mountains outside of Priest River. But now Schweitzer will be running those backcountry tours off the backside. You guys are skiers a bit, right?
I'm probably the only one in town who doesn't ski or snowboard.
Actually, I'd be the second. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Talking to journalists here. Right?
and a high school basketball coach. So, busy in the winter.
That backside has really got some good training on it. If you ever get up there and get fired up to do some skiing and snowboarding. The Bellwood building, its renovation has been named to receive the prestigious Orchid Award, which honors building renovations statewide that achieve tasteful remodels of historic structures. There's also an Onion Award out there for projects that don't qualify and fail to observe cultural or historic history. The Bellwood building is named after Ernie Bellwood, who operated Bellwood's Furniture from 1975 to 2011. I think everybody in the room remembers Burton. Ernie. And he sold at that time to Pondere Winery owners Steve and Julie Meyer, and they spearheaded that renovation project. And I thought I would mention the fires, because we have haze out there. We don't have any fires right nearby, but we do have fires in eastern Washington. And there's four fires that are clustered really more towards central Washington, north central Washington. There's four fires clustered up there. And then in southern BC, there's several fires, four that are out of control near Nelson. And I think, and there's a whole bunch of fires further north. I think the haze that we're experiencing right now in our air quality is coming from that. And of course, we're looking at high temperatures here for the next 5 days, supposed to be up to 102 by Sunday. And the National Weather Service is predicting that we're going to see a lot of haze during that period of time.
Hey, Chris, do you remember back when the smoke was like a 2 week span because it was they were burning the grass seed and
I remember it. It was actually very intense during that period of time.
Yes,
but it was very confined to that, and we weren't seeing all the wildfire smoke at that time. So, yeah, now we see a season that starts in July and runs, you know, well into September.
Well, and sometimes even earlier.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, times have changed in terms of, that, of course, is kind of keyed on, there's some forest management practices that are responsible for that, but also the hotter, drier summers that we have. I think there's no question about that.
Every summer breaks a record, right?
It does.
Every summer is hotter than the last so far.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's pray for rain here coming up as soon as possible. So, Zach, let's circle back on the big story, I think, of the week, which is that we do have a suspect that's charged in that Army surplus fire. That fire took down, completely destroyed the Army surplus store there at the corner of 5th and Oak, kind of a landmark building. I'm not sure what the history of that building was prior to the Army surplus, but it had been there for probably pushing a century. I don't know, a long time.
I was told by the fire chief, Gavin Gilchrist, that building had had multiple uses over many, many years and tons of additions and add-ons. And, you know, other reporting has suggested that there was all kinds of, like, really old timbers in that building. So somebody should dig into it. I mean, I haven't had time to actually look back into the archives to find out what all's been in that space. But it's been a lot of things. But for a lot of us, I think at least for the past generation, it's been the Army surplus. I mean, it used to be on First Avenue, if you're old enough to remember that.
That's right.
I used to go in there as a kid.
It was in the building that has now, what, the bank?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. But then it moved over to Fifth Avenue. I don't even know when, but it feels like most of my life.
Yeah.
Probably in the 90s or early 90s, maybe it moved over.
Could
there.
Have been.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely, that's my memory of that building is the Army surplus store.
Yeah.
So and that's owned by Cornell Razor.
Well, the business, the building right, was not exactly. owned by Cornell.
Right. No. Exactly. The business was owned by Cornell Razor.
Right.
And of course, I mean, it was a total loss. So he lost everything in there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a pretty big story for a lot of reasons. I mean, first of all, the fire was very big. I heard about it as it was happening. I was at my house and I got a text from someone at the city letting me know that the Army surplus was on fire. So I ran over there and saw it sort of in full flame, and I heard the ammunition going off inside, and there were hundreds of people standing around. So it was a very dramatic scene in that regard. And then how totally it was devastated was also pretty dramatic. And I went by there the day after, and they had bulldozers and like excavators or whatever out there just tearing down the remaining bits. They were still hosing it actively at that hour. There was still smoke everywhere. And of course, you know, people, the outpouring of sympathy and support for, you know, the Razor family who's operated that business and owned it for a long time.
And then also they were in a transition phase with their house, right? So there was a whole lot of personal belongings.
They had just built a house. And so they had just a ton of really precious personal items in there. There was a piano, I think, that Cornell had since he was 11 or something. And they had a, you know, vintage handmade guitar was in there, like, you know, Kim Razor's clothing. Just anything you can imagine, you know, that they would be storing in that building was all just a total, total loss. So, I mean, there was the shock of that. And then in pretty short order, I think it was on the 16th of July, the city of Sandpoint announced that they had a suspect. They had released some video footage prior to that from surveillance cameras in the area, and it showed really kind of grainy footage, as most surveillance footage is, of an individual walking, you know, sort of on Oak Street and then going down the alley, and then they cut it off at that point. And we asked why we didn't get to see the part of the video that showed the fire starting, and, you know, the presumption was that they didn't want to give away that detail so that if anybody had any tips, they could independently corroborate that they knew what they were talking about, not just describing what they'd seen on the video. So we had that, and we put that in the paper the 11th. But on the 16th, the city said they had a suspect, and they identified the individual as Jennifer S. Meyer. So we heard about that on the 16th. So on the 17th, we spent basically all day trying to piece that thing together to publish it for the 18th. And she was brought to court in the afternoon on the 17th here in Bonner County in front of Magistrate Judge Luke Hagelberg. And so there were a couple, two reporters there, me and Carolyn from the B. Cornell was there. I think there was some family members of his, a couple of detectives maybe, and just maybe two other individuals. So it wasn't a huge group of people there. And it was intended to be a video hearing, as they often do for these first appearances. So like a live feed from the jail, like a Zoom call. And the judge decided to move the Meyer matter up to first on the docket because there was people there to see it. So there was a kind of a shuffle in the jail to get her up there. And if you've ever been to one of these hearings, I'm sure you have, but for people who haven't, you sit in the courtroom and there's a big screen. The judge is there sort of sitting next to the screen, and you get a live Zoom feed into a room in the jail. And it's sort of a kind of a cell looking room with a little chair right in the middle, right in front of the camera. And then the inmate will be brought in by jail personnel through a door, and they'll come and sit at the chair, look at the camera, and then the judge will address them in that way. There's a public defender on one of the other Zoom cameras, and that's how it proceeds. And it's usually just pretty much formalities. You know, you talk about the charges, you talk about, you know, the potential penalties. There's conditions of release. There's, you know, notification of rights, of course. And then the inmates are given an opportunity to say something. You know, like maybe not plead their case, but if they have any statements to make, you know, they can direct them to the judge. And then the judge will set, you know, sort of the bail or, you know, the bond and kind of give them sort of what the next steps are. And that's usually how it goes. Well, when Meyer was brought into the room, she walked in the front, like through the door, and approached the stool. And then the audience who was watching could hear her say, you know, no, I can't do this. You know, I can't do this. No, I can't do this on video. I can't do video. And she sort of kept repeating that phrase in variations, and then sort of backed out of the room. And you could hear jail personnel sort of urging her to come back in and say, you know, you need to sit down and talk to the judge. And she just kept saying, no, I can't do it. I won't do video. At that point, the judge kind of, what I gathered later, because I haven't covered a lot of these kinds of things. Crime and courts are not my expertise, so I wasn't really aware if this was unusual or not. But I heard later that it was. Is that the judge said, well, you know, bring her down here. Like, we need to do this. We need to get her here in person. So they brought her down from the jail. It took about 20 minutes or so. So they heard a couple other cases during that time. But, you know, about 20 minutes later, she was there at the courthouse. And it was interesting. I mean, it was dramatic. I mean, we were sitting there watching, and you could sort of hear the, like, the chains rattling as she's coming up the hallway. And she comes in the room, and she's shackled sort of at ankles and wrists. She's in the jail garb. You know, the yellow jumpsuit and kind of orange rubber shoes. She didn't really look at anybody. She, you know, didn't interact with anyone. She just kind of walked slowly up to the table, sat her down. The judge started to address her, and her reaction was to put her head on the table and just became completely unresponsive. Bailiffs sort of moved in and stood around her. The judge proceeded with the normal routine, but she didn't respond to anything. Although he said, you know, based on the fact that I could hear you talking on the video just now, I know you're hearing me, and I know that you could respond if you wanted to, but you're just choosing not to. So therefore, he proceeded with what he was there to do. Set the bail bond at $1 million. And he did that during the hearing because of the flight risk that he described, and that was described by the prosecuting attorney. And that was based on the fact that she'd lived in a lot of different places, in a lot of different residences. And also that when they went to her house, to her current residence with a search warrant, they found evidence that she was probably thinking about skipping town. And it had just a bag full of stuff that you would need to leave, including like $1,000, $1,200 in silver. There were like vehicle titles, birth certificate, passport, just all the equipment you would
need.
And
she also had a firearm, right?
And she had a 9mm sidearm with ammunition. So they took that to be, you know, suspected of, like, oh, this is a bug out bag, you know. That, of course, hasn't been proved, but it was enough for them to think, wow, this person could leave and get very far away very quickly if they wanted to. So based on that concern and just the severity of the crime and the potential devastation, I mean, it devastated the building, but it was so dangerous just for the people that were around it and the other and surrounding businesses. And it was a miracle that it didn't get worse. I mean, it was bad as it was, but not a single other building was damaged. Not a single individual was harmed. And that's incredible to consider. And especially if you'd been there and
all the people hanging around and seen the ammunition going off.
Yeah. Well, and just the scene. I mean, the people, they were in a party mood. Like, they were just coming off 4th of July. The Lions Club fireworks display at City Beach had just ended. You know, the people had been drinking. They were all headed home, whatever. And, you know, anecdotally, I heard that people were just, like, buying beer and chips and sitting around. And I personally heard people say, this is like a second grand finale. Yeah. And, you know, you stand there and, like, well, the sound you're hearing is not firecrackers. Mm-hmm. It's who knows how many rounds of ammunition. And so, I mean, it was an incredibly dangerous fire for the people who were around it, and especially for the firefighters. And the fact that they did as good of a job as they did is just tremendous. Like, yeah. I mean, they deserve a huge thanks from the community for the work they did that night. So based on that flight risk, based on the severity of the fire and the potential danger to it, and just, I guess, the way that the prosecutor sort of framed it as, like, this was the busiest time that this possibly could have happened. And I guess you can read into that what you will. But just, I mean, the timing of it especially sort of, like, puts just sort of a punctuation point on just how dangerous and bad this was for the community. So she's in jail. I guess the July 31st is the date I heard for the next hearing. And that's basically what we know about the legal process as it stands. Now, the conversation turned immediately to, like, who is this person? And, you know, the moment they released the name, of course, that was what social media did, was just pounce all over this and start doing their amateur sleuthing and speculating about motive. And, you know, it has to be underscored over and over again that we do not have any idea why this person allegedly did what they allegedly did. Mm-hmm. And it's still alleged. Like, this, she's still suspect.
Don't forget that.
Yes. Yeah. This is, I mean, she's innocent until it is proven guilty, right? So there's no motive known. It's all allegation. It's all suspected. But that hasn't stopped people from going very, very far afield. And I can get to that in a little bit. But figuring out who this person was, I guess, was the first inclination for people. And it was my first inclination, too, when I saw her name. So when I got to the office on the 17th, the first thing I did was start plugging in her name, trying to find out, you know, where she lived, what she did. It became pretty clear pretty quickly that this was an individual who's better known as Jen Meyer, who ran Bonner Media, which is a printing and sign company. It's her company keeps being described in various circles as a publishing company, which makes it sound like, you know, like a newspaper or something. They did publish books, like self-published sort of, you know, boutique books, but mostly it was signage and, you know, sort of like marketing materials. And you go to Bonner Media's website and you'll see a gallery, and you'll recognize a lot of high profile local businesses have used her. So knowing that, you know, she was the owner of Bonner Media, then, you know, we go to the, like, Secretary of State's office and try to figure out, you know, the business filings and stuff. And one thing that popped out to me almost immediately was her address listed, principal address for Bonner Media was listed, at a Segal address, which I won't give. I mean, it's publicly available, but I think it's irresponsible to name the address. Mm-hmm. Others have publicly, which I find reprehensible. Mm-hmm. It's an address in Segal, is what I'll say.
Yeah, in an era of doxing,
right, where
people whose personal information is published like that, they end up carrying a brunt of a lot of invective. Yeah.
So, we found in the public documents that are filed with the Secretary of State that she had a principal address in Segal that corresponds to the home address of Steve Johnson, who is the Democratic candidate for District 1 County Commissioner. And he's run for a number of offices. I mean, he's no stranger to politics watchers in the county. He's run for legislature. He's run as a Democrat. He's run as an independent. He's run as a write-in. He's run for, I believe, House. He's run for Senate. He's run, I mean, so he can be accurately described as a perennial candidate. And he has served with the Bonner County Democrats in the past. So that connection was surprising. That was not on my bingo card when I was doing my background search for Jennifer S. Meyer. But seeing that, I was like, well, I need to call Steve and ask him what's up with this. So I reached out to Steve and he got back to me and explained that the reason that was there, as far as he could tell, was that she had rented a room on his farm. And this is his family farm. He's lived there for 50 plus years. And they rent rooms to people because they have acreage and, you know, they have space and whatever. And so she was one of these individuals who came in 2017 and rented a room. Steve described her as earthy type, like an earthy type person, really into gardening, really into farmers markets. She was very active in like area farmers markets, like from Athol all the way up here. According to him, he saw her spend the majority of her time working in the garden and was very good at it. He saw no indication that she was, you know, into drugs or alcohol or anything like that. And during the hearing, you know, the judge didn't said that there was no allegations of drugs or alcohol in the case either. So that doesn't seem to be part of her personality. And of course, Steve says if she was, you know, like into drugs and alcohol, they probably wouldn't have rented to her in the first place. So, and she was apolitical, according to him. He never had any political conversations with her. He never saw her express anything overtly political. And she never seemed to behave erratically in any way or unusually. Again, I mean, he just kept repeating to this description of she was very earthy. Like she just wanted to work in the garden. She lived at that residence from 2017 to 2019. And Steve Johnson says he hadn't had a single interaction with her since she moved out. And that was about the time she quit doing the gardening thing, like the farmer's market thing, and then got into the printing publishing business. And she worked for, I think it was Selkirk Printing. Chris would know better than me.
It wasn't Selkirk. It was Mountain Sky.
Mountain Sky, I believe. Yeah. So she worked there as a kind of a graphic designer, I guess. Yeah. And then when they closed up shop, she acquired that business and turned it into Bonner Media. And that was somewhere in late 2020. And
that's about right, yeah.
And she'd done business with all kinds of people. I mean, from that time forward. And that's what we could dig up on her, really. And that's where it kind of gets really, I don't know, it gets unfortunate, even more unfortunate, you know, for the fact that it's just an unfounded rumor mill that has developed around this supposed connection between Steve Johnson, a Democratic political candidate, and the burning of the Army Surplus, which, you know, owned by Cornell Razor, who is a also longtime political figure in the community. He was a county commissioner at one point. He's been a longtime affiliate with the Bonner County Republican Central Committee. He's worked with the state Republican Party, and he is running now for the House. Mm-hmm. So he's a candidate as well in this upcoming election. And that's what makes this especially sort of supercharged.
Right.
I mean, I think the appropriate response that a lot of people have had has been to express sympathy for the Razor family, gratitude toward the first responders, and patience with the law enforcement officials to do their job and get the details rather than speculate. Mm-hmm. And that was going pretty well, I think, for a little while. I mean, there was chatter on Facebook and people would make off color comments, either being, you know, either happy or not sad, you know, that the Army Surplus burned down because they perceived it as sort of a misfortune that befell a political enemy because they didn't like Cornell's politics. So you had that side of it. And then you had the other side where the immediate comment was like, well, this must have been some kind of, you know, liberal attack, you know, against this man and his family and his politics. Cornell has been, I think, very gracious in his response. Everything that he's posted online, everything that I've heard him say has been, you know, it's surreal. It's a tragedy for him. He's heartbroken. He's lost 40 plus years of his life's work, but he has kind of leaned toward his faith, which is very high profile in public, that, you know, he hopes for justice, but he also kind of hopes for mercy for this individual should they be found guilty. Mm-hmm. And he hasn't ascribed any sort of political motivation. He hasn't gone there.
And he, I did see a comment that he doesn't know her.
No.
Yeah. He hasn't done business with her Yeah. You're speculating about motives that you might be hit some kind of grudge or some personal grudge. But
well, and speculation about motive is exactly that, and it's irresponsible to speculate. Yeah. Although we do have a sitting Idaho District 1 senator who will no longer be our senator after January because he lost his primary, Scott Herndon, who has decided to go there. He posted two videos on his Facebook page, one on the 17th and one on last night on the 18th, where he outright speculates that because of this apparent connection between Steve Johnson and Jennifer Meyer, that the Democrats have somehow colluded. His phrase was, this doesn't happen in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. He doesn't come outright and say, like, the Democrats did this, but he's clearly trying to connect these dots, and he's giving out addresses. And that led the Bonner County Democrats to release a statement yesterday, which I haven't had a chance to report because the paper was already out, where they kind of condemned Herndon for doing this. You know, they say, we're disappointed that Mr. Herndon has chosen to release baseless accusations and misinformation, and we feel that it is important to set the record straight. And I listened to both those videos, and in them, it's clear that Herndon hadn't read the reader because he kept shrugging and was like, well, I don't know why there's connections here. I don't know why this would be, like, how come her address is this? Well, I mean, you could call Steve and ask him.
Yeah.
He rented a room to her for 2 years, and he hasn't seen her in close to five. And he has no idea why she kept his address on those filings.
It just could have been something she didn't deal with after she moved.
She had, yeah. I mean, if you look back at the further records, she has changed addresses many times. Mm-hmm. She had P.O. boxes in Cocalala and Sandpoint, and she had an office in Ponderay. I haven't seen the arrest report or the search warrant or whatever that yet, but I've seen that her actual residence was on Oak Street. So that was one of the things the judge even said. You know, she had lived in many places and had many residences. So this was a pattern of her behavior, was living in different places, having different addresses. She was changing things all the time. Steve Johnson says, I had no idea that my address was attached to these documents. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the absence of any other evidence, I believe him. Mm-hmm. I don't know why he would lie. And maybe there's more to it. I don't think so, but yeah. I'm not going to speculate, although some are.
Let's not forget, she does have a presumption of innocence at this point.
Absolutely.
Yep. A lot of people are coming down on her. Certainly it can't be just based on video. There must be other evidence there that that she committed this act.
And it's to the law enforcement officials that this should fall. Like, we're not the junior sleuths. I mean, we can use the tools we have available.
Well, you have a Facebook page. Of course you can be a sleuth.
Right. And
it seems to go.
And it does bear repeating and underscoring, you know, that the investigation is ongoing. The Sandpoint police are looking actively for more tips, for more information. And they have invited, of course, the public to continue giving those tips. And they have a number you can call. And Chief Kuhn at the last city council meeting did confirm that these are anonymous. So you don't have to worry about retribution or whatever. But if people have information, if they interacted with Jennifer Meyer on July 4th, if they have anything they can share that might help, doesn't matter if the police already know it or not. Yeah. Anything helps. The number that they want you to call is 208-265-1482.
Okay, well, we're going to run out of time, as we usually do. But let's talk for a little bit, at least, about the Sandpoint Council approving the updated comprehensive plan for the city. And they just did that this on a Wednesday, I think, during the regular meeting. The comprehensive plan is designed to guide growth and decision making. It's not a zoning document per se. It doesn't actually have the rules in it, but it just articulates the vision. So how does this update differ from what the city already had in place?
Yeah, so Jason Welker, who's our community planning and development director, he did a good job of really kind of highlighting, you know, what the main differences are. And what they come down to really is like a greater emphasis on inclusivity. That was a major priority, getting the community engaged. Community engagement has always been, you know, a big deal, but especially over the past couple of years, that has been a major touch point for people, is getting the community like really engaged in what's going on at City Hall. So that was really baked into the pie. Sustainability and resilience, that wasn't really a thing that we cared about in 2009. Sustainability, that wasn't, I mean, that word was out there, but it wasn't really, you know, like a goal. Really paying more attention to our population estimates, because in 2009, our population had held pretty steady. You look at our population now, and we need to be very vigilant about planning for that increase. They're saying by 2040, a very conservative estimate is 15,000, and they emphasized conservative estimate. I mean, beyond that, really, it's just it's about looking more toward that long-term sustainability and that keeping community engaged, whereas the old plan was more about development within a core. Like, we were trying to avoid sprawl. That was our main concern in 2009, was that we weren't going to have, you know, like the Rastrum Prairie popping up here. And so we were trying to get really close to getting our density. Now we're not so worried about density because we have it. Now we're worried about, like, how do we make this sustainable density? How do we make sure that we have housing that's affordable? That wasn't really a concern in 2009. I mean, the market had just cratered in 2008. homes were still, you know, like $100,000. I remember looking at homes back then and thinking like, oh, this house is $115,000. That's ridiculous. You know, now you can't even buy a doghouse for $115,000. So that's a new component of the comp plan, is really looking at community housing and making sure that housing affordability is a goal. So I mean, those are the main things, really. It's like we've grown up quite a bit in 15 years, and this is a much more sort of nuanced, I think, maybe, I'm not gonna say grown up plan, but a more thoughtful sort of for like future seeking. I mean, they're all supposed to be future seeking. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're 20-year vision plans, but I don't know. This one to me seems a little more fine tuned, a little more nuanced, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks to how long it's been in process. 5 years to write this plan. Granted, that was held up by COVID, but still, I mean, there have been a lot of people looking at this thing and combing through it. Joint sessions of planning and zoning and city council, so many workshops, so many surveys. If anybody didn't get a chance to look at this thing, then they weren't paying attention, like, or didn't know they could, you know, they weren't looking.
Well, they weren't paying attention.
Yeah. I mean, they had many, like, many opportunities to be a part of this process.
They had a whole bunch of workshops. They did surveys.
Yeah.
And you can go see the plan right now if you go to the city website.
And I have a link to it in the story. I even shortened it for you. It's a bit.ly link. So
obviously, we've talked about this is a guide for the future. Can you just give us a sense of what that might look like in some type of project or you know, how that might manifest through a decision that the city might make in the future?
I think that the major one for the mayor, and he said this over and over again, is the wastewater treatment plant. And that doesn't sound like a very sexy project, but it is critical to underpinning all the other growth and development that will happen. And, you know, some people have beat the drum for the wastewater treatment plant consistently, but for the most part, people just sort of, they hear it and they go, you know, we'll figure that out. But it is a critical, critical thing. And at the last council meeting, Mayor Grimm said that he's got the governor and, or the governor's office, and the congressional office is coming up here next week to tour. And so he's trying to get state and federal interest and buy-in on this project. It was originally slated to be sort of a medium-term project in the comp plan, but at that meeting, when they approved the plan, they agreed to move it up to a short term. So that's a good example of a really big, and it's going to be one of the biggest capital projects the city's ever done.
Mm-hmm. What about maintaining character of the downtown? How's that incorporated into the vision?
That's in sort of the first part of the document, where they really establish community values and talk about how we need to maintain sort of the scale and the massing of the buildings in. Well, and first we have to establish districts, and that's a process of code that they're going to start working on quickly. After they approved the plan, they had sort of another conversation about their internal priorities, like how the council wanted to direct the mayor to direct staff to start directing attention towards some of these things. And the main thing they wanted to do was look at sort of downtown and surrounds, getting some new codes written about, you know, architectural style, about historic districts, about sort of the scale that you can build to.
Building height.
Yeah. I mean, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So those codes are going to be probably top of the list to establish for downtown and, you know, sort of the downtown, the greater downtown area, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. So look for that coming up soon. And this is going to be months and months and probably years. Mm-hmm. But that is one of the top priorities. Mm-hmm. Wastewater treatment plant as a project, and then getting sort of downtown and surrounds code stuff seems to me to be the top two things that we're going to see happen first.
And we are really actually over time here, but is anything, well, if anything you want to throw out there that came up during the week that needs explication here?
I just think the warm temperatures are something to keep an eye on. And then, you know, we've got the festival starting next week. So town is already super busy, but it's going to get even more busy.
Yeah. And don't we have a bunch of guys coming through town today? Did I read a story in the Reader about a thousand Mini Cooper caravan
coming through? It's a big national road rally, and they go from, like, I think it's New Mexico or somewhere down in the Southwest. Ben wrote the story.
And they're coming from Missoula in this leg, and this is one of their designated stops. It doesn't mean they'll all stop, but expect to see a bunch of Mini Coopers around town today.
Tons and tons. Yeah. Be ready.
Well, they're neat little cars. Yeah. I got to say that. So, well, thank you for listening today, folks. We will be back again next Friday with news of next week. And we're going to go out right now. We're going to have a few songs we're going to hear. And then actually we're going to have a second part of Democracy Now! Is going to come on. I think they're talking about the Republican National Convention. So here we go with a selection of music, and keep listening. Thank you for listening today, and have a great week.
Andre.
You can't find him, the way is dim, you feel like giving.